From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those midweek open lines for you. Here's what's happening. An overseas tip about an imminent bombing of the Metro Red Line's Universal City Station has forced federal and law enforcement officials in Los Angeles to swiftly ramp up security across its sprawling transit system. An anonymous man warned of a potential attack and provided the information on a tip line abroad as well. FBI is involved, too. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, is calling for Germany's burqa ban, saying that the full veil is not appropriate here. What does that all mean? Let's check in with Jerry Corsi, author of WND.com and Partners in Crime. Jerry, that's a little strong for Germany to take this position, isn't it?
It is, George, and I think Merkel was very circumspect in exactly how she stated it, because it wasn't a full ban on burqas. It was under appropriate circumstances and other issues. Merkel's running for a fourth term in Germany, and there's tremendous opposition to the amount of influx of refugees, Muslim refugees, which have flooded now Germany. And Merkel's up against a very tough issue on this, because the EU and Merkel are open borders and open to refugees, and the Muslims who have come into Germany are not assimilating into Germany. So it's a very difficult issue, and unless she gives some on this, which she's trying to do, she won't get reelected.
And in this particular case, any ramifications from the Muslim community about this?
Well, I think the Muslims are understanding, at least at the moment, that it's a political statement. But I think if Merkel were really to crack down on Sharia law or Muslim practices in Germany right now, there'd be a lot of conflict. So it's a very delicate situation. Germany is changing rapidly. The refugees are not assimilating. There's an increasing number of them, and it's a major political issue right now in Germany. And Merkel recognized it, otherwise she would not have said this burqa possible crackdown is going to occur. So, George, this is kind of a threshold point in Germany as to whether or not they're going to accept the Muslim immigration, or it's going to break Merkel's fourth election chances.
Hey, Jerry, I wanted to let you know we were strangely getting very close to getting that interview set up with you and me and Fidel Castro through his son. And, of course, he dies on us, so it's not going to happen. But we got close.
Isn't that interesting, George? Well, I mean, it was amazing. And it seemed like for a time there that Fidel was almost never going to die. And it's amazing. But, we'll have another opportunity, George, and we'll take it for some other internationally important figure. I'm always open to it.
All right. Jerry Corsi, WND.com. President-elect Donald Trump blasted Boeing for alleged overcosts, overruns, and called for the government to cancel the contract as the company works to build a new fleet of Air Force One jets that would replace the current aging Reagan-era planes. But Donald Trump simply said, hey, as he tweeted, more than $4 billion, cancel the order. That's pretty gutsy, isn't it? An off-duty sheriff's deputy died and two other people injured when two vehicles plunged into a water-filled sinkhole in San Antonio. Jeez, wrong place, wrong time. Joy to the world, right? Tis the season to be jolly. Festive music fills the air. Holiday cheer abounds. Everyone is happy at holiday time, right? Wrong. Truth be told, many people feel lonely, sad, anxious, depressed at this time of year. How can that be? Well, there are many reasons why people feel down at the holiday time. Some of the reasons, of course, let's check in with Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, why are so many people down during the holiday season?
Well, you're right, George, that there are a lot of different reasons. And I think each person can kind of ask themselves what's happening. If you look at what you're anticipating coming up, say, at Christmas time or at a Christmas visit, it may remind you of some sad times you have had as a child that you really haven't thought about or let percolate to the surface, because often Christmases are disappointing for people when they're kids and there are tough times and conflicts in the family. So that's one of the main things, is a re-stimulation, just difficult Christmases past. Another is that it brings us together with family members that we may not get along with, or we may have had conflicts with in the past. When you work with young people, the way I often do here in a college community in Ithaca, you can just see the stress and the strain on young people, many of them, when they go home for Thanksgiving or Christmas or the summer, because it puts you into close proximity with people with whom you've not worked out a lot of conflicts. Might be a brother, sister, might be a mother, father. I think another thing is unrealistic expectations. We get an overly optimistic picture of how extended families are supposed to do. And often, when we're going to visit an extended family, we have to be patient and lower our expectations. And I think there's some other things we can do on the way. I think one of the most important things is to think with yourself about what's going on, and does it give you a signal for changing your future? Do you want to get closer to some family members? Do you want to move further away from them? I think it can be really helpful if you're going now it's Christmas time coming up, if you're and New Year's and the Jewish holidays, of course, and if you're going to a place where you're not sure you're comfortable, but you've decided you really want to go, talk to a loved one, either your wife, your husband, or one of your kids, or someone you're going to see there, and spend special time with them. Watch each other's back. Take care of each other. I know when I go places anywhere with my wife, into large groups, conferences, we always talk about, how are we going to take care of each other? What are we going to look out for? Who do we want to see? Who do we don't want to see? And limit your expectations at the holidays. But also think seriously about what you want and make it work better over the coming year. Maybe you want to get closer to folks over the coming year. Maybe you want to move further away from people. So use all this stuff as a signal for living your life better in the coming year.
Peter, I'm glad I don't need a psychiatrist, but if I did, I'd want to use you.
Thank you very much, Judge. Hey, listen, happy season's greetings to all your millions of wonderful, wonderful listeners.
You too, Peter. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you again, Dr. Peter Briggin. A team of international archaeologists believe a pair of mummified legs on display in an Italian museum may belong to Egyptian Queen Nefertari, the favorite wife of the pharaoh Ramses II. Another amazing discovery. Well, this is the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, a day that will live in infamy.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
75 years ago, what really happened? What led up to this? And did we even know about it in advance? Craig Nelson back with us on Coast to Coast, his latest work, Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Craig is next with me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Craig Nelson is an author, and his writings have appeared in several major publications. And before turning to writing, he was a vice president and executive editor of Harper Row, where he oversaw the publishing of 20 national bestsellers there. He's a graduate of UT Austin with a Bachelor of Science in the Humanities, also attended USC's Film School and the UCLA Writing Program, and the Harvard Radcliffe Publishing Course as well. He is back on Coast to Coast. A couple of his other books, Rocket Man and the Age of Radiance. Craig, it's always a pleasure to have you, and I can't believe 75 years since Pearl Harbor. Unbelievable.
It's amazing, isn't it, George? And what a moment to be looking back at this day in history.
Oh, jeez. In those days, and my father went to World War II, but in those days, when this attack occurred, what was going through Americans' minds at that time, Craig?
you know, we were really in a very bizarre position because a lot of Americans had very bad feelings about what happened in World War One, then called the Great War. And they felt that the only benefit had been for European royalty and arms manufacturers. And now here we were going through this all over again with Hitler and Mussolini. And they weren't even really thinking about the Japanese. There was sort of an idea in America that the Japanese couldn't be trusted, but that they weren't really powerful enough to do anything to us. So there wasn't really that much of that going on about Asia. But people were worried about, with the fall of France, American citizens became actively worried about World War II.
Craig, did we provoke the Japanese?
Well, there was one thing that happened in one way that we did provoke them, and that was the fact that an admiral working in Asia came up with the idea of using economic embargoes as pressure against the Japanese instead of using troops, which we didn't have enough of anyway at the
mm-hmm.
time. And Roosevelt seized on this, and he came up with an idea of using a combination of licenses and freezing of Japanese funds to manipulate the Japanese and be able to withhold their oil at any time. 80% of their oil came from America at that time. But two guys went behind his back, one at Treasury and one at State, and engineered a full embargo of that petroleum, and that really pushed Japan into a corner.
Why did we even do that in the first place? What was wrong? What was going on?
Well, the Japanese, beginning in 1931, were attacking our allies, the Chinese. And as part of trying to get them, they were doing these horrific war crimes, and they were not able to actually win the war, but they kept waging it anyway because they couldn't figure out a way out. So they kept trying to take over more and more and more territory, and none of it was actually succeeding, so their plan was just to keep taking more territory in this sort of ravenous search for empire.
Spent 9 years with the Navy, Craig, and I visited only by air Pearl Harbor one time when I had an event in Honolulu, and I couldn't grasp how small, up in a plane, of course, looking down, how small that area looked. And you look at it and you go, we got involved in another war because of this, and it was just eerie is all get up. I can't explain it.
Well, it is a very small anchorage, and both of the heads of the fleet at the time, Richardson and Kimmel, complained about it, but it was our best-funded overseas base besides the Panama Canal. At that moment, the two best-equipped bases were Pearl Harbor and the Panama Canal. So it was quite a military catastrophe when it was taken down.
In your book, Pearl Harbor, you have done an extensive job with new material and research. How long did it take you to work on this one?
I hired a team of about a dozen researchers, and we spent 5 years on it, and we researched everything from scratch. And what people don't really realize about doing this is when you do this seriously, it is the Everest of research, Pearl Harbor. There are 9 federal investigations in Pearl Harbor, and they have all of the documents from those investigations in one location, and they are 48 feet long. So if you think of a filing cabinet 48 feet long, that's your starting point. The Japanese have now finished publishing their official account. It is 103 volumes. So you are just looking at a real mountain if you want to take this seriously, and that's what we did.
Did we know that this was going to happen?
Well, we knew the Japanese were going to strike, but for 2 years, the military told Roosevelt and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, that Japan was the Gibraltar of the Pacific, that we had 43,000 servicemen stationed there, that no one would dare attack us in Hawaii. So we thought they were going to attack Guam. We thought they might attack Wake. We thought they might attack Midway. We thought they might attack Philippines. But nowhere is Hawaii ever mentioned in any military intelligence reports ahead of time. And they maintained this position, and this inspired Hull and Roosevelt to be sort of belligerent in dealing with the Japanese. Hull was this amazing guy who had 53 meetings with the Japanese ambassadors in 1941, and after every meeting he went off and wrote down everything that everyone said, or he at least had his secretary write down everything that everyone said. So you actually have detailed moment-by-moment notes from every conversation they had with them. And so the military is telling Hull and Roosevelt that we're super powerful and no one would dare attack us. Until July excuse me, yeah, no, until November 5th, 1941, when they say, actually, you know, we've been wrong. Japan is a lot more powerful than we are, and you've got to play for time. But by then, it's too late. You can see Roosevelt doing everything he can. He tries to turn Indochina into Switzerland. He tries to get them to agree to a peace accord, a temporary peace accord. He even goes over the backs of both governments and writes directly to Emperor Hirohito. But it's too late.
Prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, what were the Japanese doing at that time? They were battling other areas, right?
The Japanese were in the middle of taking over one of the greatest invasions of military history. They called it Operation Number One. They had parts of coastal China and a colony in Korea before that time. But now they were going to take over all of Southeast Asia from Kamchatka in the northeast to India in the southwest. So they would have all of coastal China. They would have all of Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. They would have Malaysia. They would have what is today's Indonesia. They would have Hong Kong. They would have Singapore. And they actually did this in a six-month period. It is one of the most amazing strikes of all time. And Hawaii, Operation Hawaii, was a very tiny rearguard action to protect their flank. And it was sort of a crazy idea dreamed up by Admiral Yamamoto that if Hawaii were decimated, American citizens would just give up and say, okay, you can have Asia. We can't do anything about you. And, of course, we know what actually happened next.
And had they not attacked us, would we have still gotten involved?
We would have gotten involved because they were so viciously attacking the Chinese. But I do believe that there was one point with the last civilian emperor, Konoye, who came before Tojo. After Tojo, there was no hope. But as Konoye was in there, he was in the middle of preparing to meet with Roosevelt aboard a battleship off the coast of Alaska and hammer out a peace settlement, which Emperor Hirohito was in favor of. And I believe the two of them could have done that peace settlement, and I believe they would have withdrawn from China. They would have stopped their military campaigns. They would have switched over to using treaties and civilian negotiations, and Pearl Harbor would have been avoided.
Craig Nelson with us, his book, Pearl Harbor. I have a feeling that China's going to have the last laugh over Japan. Now, that's just a gut feeling, but what do you think?
Well, this is actually the big issue with the whole argument going on now between the new administration, the incoming Trump administration and the Obama administration. One of the main ideas of that Trans-Pacific Partnership was to serve up the United States as a bulwark against the Chinese, using that as sort of a kind of economic leverage. And so that's an avenue that's gone now. So there you are.
Now, when you were doing your work and investigation, there was something about a mysterious ad for a board game in the New Yorker. What was that all about?
Right. This is one of everyone's favorite stories in the book. On November 22nd, this very strange ad appeared in the New Yorker magazine. And if you know, if you want to ignite some bizarre fantasies, this ad will do it. Because remember, it's November 22nd, 1941, so the United States is not yet at war. And this ad says, alert, warning, if you find yourself in an air raid shelter, make sure you have with you all you need to eat and drink. And don't forget Chicago's favorite game, the Deadly Double. And then it shows a picture of two dice with the numbers 12 and 7 on them. So after the attack, the FBI thought this was very, very suspicious. And they investigated, and they found out that the game and the guy who was the company that was supposed to make it never existed, and that the guy who took out the ad did it in person with the mechanicals, meaning the produced, finished ad, and he paid in cash, so he couldn't be traced. And so that's that may be a Pearl Harbor mystery that exists to this day.
You never know. You never know. We're going to take a break pretty soon, Craig, but we're going to come back for more. And then we're going to take calls next hour with you, too, this being the 75th anniversary of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor. How many soldiers did we lose there?
2,403, and amazingly, 2,000 are still alive right now.
Still?
Uh-huh. We have 2,000 survivors of Pearl Harbor left. They're all in their 90s. And part of the reason we have them is because all of the senior officers were asleep in their beds on the land when this happened.
That's right.
The only people on the ships, and you may remember this from your era, the only people on the ships and on the airfields were very young kids. So you could get in the Navy then at 16, and many lied and got in at 15.
That's
so
right.
A lot of Pearl Harbor survivors are 14, 15, 16, 17.
Yeah, a lot of young people. We're going to come back in a moment, Craig, and talk more about your work, Pearl Harbor. Welcome back to Coast, Craig Nelson with us, his book, Pearl Harbor, and that ad that was in the New Yorker that he was talking about, Lex has found it, and it's been posted on our Twitter feed, so go take a look at that. My gosh, 75 years ago. In this situation, Craig, is it true that years later, a Japanese pilot and a U.S. Marine became friends, and they were Pearl Harbor survivors?
Yes, this is one of my favorite stories from this history. And, you know, I spent so long researching the worst things human beings can do to each other. It was really great to find a story about some of the best things that happened. So this is the story of one of the lead dive bomber pilots, Zenji Abe, who after the war found out that Japan had not declared war before attacking Pearl Harbor. And he thought this was shameful and disgraceful. So Mr. Abe spent almost 10 years traveling across Japan, getting the aviators from the Pearl Harbor attack to sign a letter of apology. And then he appears in the United States. He tracks down the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association, and he goes to one of its officers' house in Atlanta and knocks on the door, and in his bad English explains who he is and about his letter. And the American says, "You can stick that letter where the sun don't shine," and slams the door in his face. So, but Abe doesn't give up, and he finally attends Pearl Harbor reunions in Hawaii on December 7th, and he meets a Marine from the West Virginia named Richard Fisk. Now, Fisk had not only survived Pearl Harbor, he had survived what he called 36 straight days of Pearl Harbor, Iwo Jima, as a Marine. So he really had a terrible, terrible World War II experience and was quite scarred by it and really hated the Japanese people. But for some reason, Zenji Abe was able to reach to him, and the two men became friends. And once a month, while he was alive, Richard Fisk, with Zenji Abe's donation, would go to Pearl Harbor and play taps, a Japanese and American version of taps, while laying down two roses.
What message, Craig, would you like everyone listening to this broadcast tonight to take away from when they get the and read Pearl Harbor?
I think when you look at Pearl Harbor, you actually see the birth of the America we know today, that we are the premier global superpower, that we have the mightiest fighting force the world has ever known, that we created the most powerful weapons the world has ever seen, that we have created the United Nations to settle differences amicably, that we have a vast network of outreach through our foreign aid programs, and that through all these things we've kept World War III from happening, is all began at Pearl Harbor.
Yet there are some people within government, I think, who would lead us into unnecessary wars for their own personal gains.
You got that right.
Yep. Absolutely. Were any of them at stake during World War II? Was there anything there that pushed us into something we should not have gone into?
I really don't think so. I think it was really beyond our control. You know, Roosevelt again and again said, "I don't want to get into the wrong war in the wrong ocean at the wrong time." And I really do think that if we had let everything fall and had stayed out of it, that the Nazis and the Japanese would have been at our throats.
Even had they not attacked us, do you think we would have eventually gotten into that conflict?
Oh, absolutely. The Nazi subs were taking down our shipping left and right in the Atlantic. There are even reports of people on vacation in Florida who the Florida towns wouldn't agree to do a voluntary blackout. So the Nazis used the lights to track down U.S. ships and bring down the tankers, and they would set them on fire so that the people on the beach could see it.
Jeez.
So sooner or later, they were going to take down an American passenger vessel, and World War would have started that way.
Did we blunder Pearl Harbor?
Well, we did in the fact that we had possibilities of negotiating a peace with Japan. The last civilian Prime Minister Konaye, he really wanted to do a peace negotiation, and that could have happened. But we couldn't hear it. We couldn't see it because we thought the Japanese were just like the Nazis, the sort of invincible force of fascism out to conquer the world, and that they couldn't be negotiated with or bargained with. But in fact, the Japanese government was so chaotic that it changed hands 15 times in 14 years. And there are various points and moments along that period where we could have negotiated with them.
Who was Dorinda Nicholson?
Dorinda is a very sweet woman. She was 6 years old at the time of the attack, and it all began for her when the door of her house caught on fire from sort of erratic strafer fire from a Japanese plane. And she ran out the house, and the father got her out. And of course, she's a little 6-year-old girl, so it's all very fun and exciting. And they're hiding in the sugarcane fields. And suddenly she realizes that her dog is missing, and maybe her dog is dead.
Oh.
And the tragedy of what is actually going on comes home to that little 6-year-old girl. So it was wonderful to go out and find people whose stories hadn't really been told before and who have given a completely different perspective on that day.
Have you been to Pearl Harbor yourself, Craig?
Oh, many times.
What's it feel like for you when you're there?
Well, they do a very beautiful job because you take this little skiff. First of all, you're in the middle of an enormous and spectacular naval base. It's a joint Army-Navy base.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite busy, and there's lots of destroyers and cruisers and ships of all nations coming in and out of it, using it, paying us good fees for refueling and things like that. But the memorial itself, they did a beautiful job with the museum. And then you take a little skiff out to the sunken Arizona. And because it was filled with oil at the time it was brought down, it's still leaking oil. So in a certain way, it's still alive. And because I've done so much research on this, I actually know many of the names on the marble wall of memorial. I know exactly who was brothers, and I know the twin brothers, where one died and one survived, and all these stories, and it just resonates with me so powerfully.
The movies on Pearl Harbor, what do you think of them?
Well, Tora 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 is pretty accurate, except that it made a big mistake in that it invented that phrase, we've awakened a sleeping
giant.
That's so right. I had to spend 3 days tracking down that that actually wasn't said by someone. It was made up.
Great statement, though, wasn't it?
It's a great line, and it sounds very similar to something that was said. But I wish I'd known that, and I didn't have to spend 3 days on that one line. But anyway, and the Hollywood movie, the Ben Affleck movie, the technology part is actually pretty good. The way the torpedoes look when they are thrown into the water, and the way the strikes look, those are pretty accurate. But the big problem is that everybody at Pearl Harbor were little tiny kids. They weren't 40-year-old Ben Affleck. So they look more like Tony Dow from Leave It to Beaver than they look like Ben Affleck.
Oh, my God. They must have been shocked that day for those kids, huh?
Really, really, you know, one of them said, one of my favorite lines was, I didn't even know they were sore at us.
Jeez.
You know, that really shows you who was there.
My gosh, my gosh. How soon did we get into the war? We got in right away, didn't we? Right after that?
Well, we announced we were in it, but we couldn't really get in it because we didn't have a fleet anymore in the Pacific. And, it took quite a while to sort of build back up to it. So what we did was, as sort of a quickie quid pro quo, we launched the Doolittle Raid, which was one of only two times in American history where the Army and Navy cooperated. And they sent a squadron of Army bombers off a Navy aircraft carrier to penetrate into Japanese home islands. And the damage they did wasn't so great. This is in April. It's only 4 months after Pearl Harbor, so it was quite an amazing operation. But the damage they did wasn't that great, but it really turned American hearts, because until that moment, most Americans thought we could not win World War II. And after the Doolittle Raid, they thought maybe we could.
What did you find to be, in your research, the most disturbing aspect of Pearl Harbor?
Well, the disturbing part about it for me was the fact that the previous accounts of the attack itself were quite sterilized and sanitized. And I'm not sure if the writers worried about readers' sensibilities. I'm not sure if it was because the eyewitness accounts were limited until very recently, because so many people suffered from trauma that they couldn't really talk about it. I'm not sure why, but they did this sort of, and I find this true with a lot of the older World War II books, they do this very cleaned-up version of war. And the reason that bothers me, George, is because, you know, we have boys today coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they have a lot of problems. And if you believe this sort of cleaned-up, pretty version of war, you think, well, it's all their fault that they have problems. If you don't realize how gruesome and horrible it really is, you have a very strange notion of what going to war means. So I tried to make sure that this book wasn't a sterilized version, and that you really saw what these poor boys went through so you can understand it.
Would you say that of all the areas of war that we had to go through during World War II, that the attack on Pearl Harbor was probably the most devastating, the most stunning attack?
Well, America, you know, if you look at its history, it got off pretty lightly in the wars. You know, we had 400,000 in World War One, and, you know, we had 8 million fighting in World War Two. But the Russians lost, like, you know, 20 million people died in World War Two for them. And nothing like that happened for us. The only thing like that that happened for us was Pearl Harbor. So I think because it was such a devastating moment compared to the rest of our wartime history, that's why it had such an incredible impact.
Heck, 9/11 took out more lives than Pearl Harbor, did it not?
Exactly. So that's the other one that eventually will have a lot of impact. But you can see how interesting history is, George, with that, because people aren't really talking about 9/11 anymore.
No, they really aren't. Mm-hmm. How many ships were out of the Pearl Harbor area when the Japanese attacked? Were there many?
There were 96 ships in the harbor, and almost every capital ship was destroyed. But the Navy salvage crews, and this is a fascinating story to me, the great unsung hero of Pearl Harbor were the Navy salvage crews who brought every single ship back to life and back into the Pacific Theater except three.
That is amazing.
In 2 years.
Amazing.
And on the cover of this book has the famous picture of the USS Shaw destroyed in dry dock, and it looks like the most devastating explosion you've ever seen. That ship was back in business in a year.
Of the three ships that did not come back, there were sailors trapped inside, too, while they sank, right?
Yes, the Oklahoma turned over, and we weren't able to rescue about 400 of the men from that ship. And they are still interred as unknowns in Punch Bowl. We can't identify their remains.
Wow.
So there's that. And then, of course, 1,000 died with the one strike. Over 1,000 died with the one strike on the Arizona. But one of the terrible things was that the bombs and the torpedoes released such an enormous amount of fuel into the water that it made a 6-inch-high film over the water, and it ignited. So many of the boys were jumping off their sinking ships into this oil and turning into matchsticks.
Oh, my God. Does it get any worse, you know, Craig? My God.
Yeah, that was the hardest part to write about.
Were there any Japanese admirals that were opposed to this attack?
All of them, actually.
Really?
One of the amazing things about
Who pushed this? Hirohito?
No, Yamamoto. One of the amazing things about this story is how the Army decided that the Navy should fight the United States, and the Navy didn't want to do it, and the Army had to try to cow them into it, and they had this very unlikely ally in Admiral Yamamoto, who, on the one hand, had spent many years in the United States and repeatedly told them over and over again, you can't go to war with America, you are going to lose, it's going to be a catastrophe. And then he'd say, but if you are going to do this, the only way we could possibly win is with a huge strike at Pearl Harbor. So the only person really pushing this was Yamamoto, and he threatened to quit twice to make it go through. And if he hadn't been so adamant, it would have never happened.
With today's technology, Craig, what kind of an attack would be on Pearl Harbor today? Would it be missiles? How would it be done?
Oh, it would be done with missiles, yeah, and of course, and very high altitude bombers and drones and all of these kind of, all of these sort of newfangled ways of unleashing horrible weapons.
But we would know it was happening. Technologically, we'd have advance notice, wouldn't we?
Well, you know, at some point, other people will have our drone technology and other people will have our stealth technology. And it seems that no matter how powerful you are, if someone wants to get you, they will find your weakness.
The planes that attacked Pearl Harbor, did they come from Japanese aircraft carriers?
They did. They did quite a remarkable, I mean, you know, when you look at this from the Japanese military perspective, it's quite an amazing achievement because they were able to study traffic patterns in the Pacific for a year, and they found this one part that was never used during the winter months because it's a gruesome way to travel. It's straight across the dead ocean in the middle of it in the winter. And so that's the route they use. And one Pearl Harbor mystery that remains to this today is that they came across a Soviet trawler called the Uritsky, only one ship they came across. And they were supposed to sink that ship, but they didn't. And the Uritsky should have reported this giant Japanese fleet heading towards the United States to the Soviet Union, but we don't know what happened with that.
What lessons have we learned here, Craig? Anything?
Well, I believe that one of the big lessons is, as you know, the Japanese were disgusting war criminals, and they were doing horrible things in Asia. But if we had sort of toned down our rhetoric and not been a little so bullying with them, we might have negotiated a peace with them. And the other thing I think that you can learn from 9/11 and Pearl Harbor is that the reason both of those attacks were so successful was because they were so unimaginable. The Americans in the 1940s couldn't imagine the Japanese were capable of doing this. And the Americans in our time, we just couldn't imagine suicide teams were willing to do such a thing. So these attacks were beyond our belief, and the next one that comes will be equally beyond our belief.
Did we just not give the Japanese credit for what they had in terms of weaponry?
It was like we were blind to them because of our feelings about Asians. There's one fantastic, well, you know, there's a great line where the commander of Wheeler, a Mr. Flood, after it happened, says, "I can't believe those little yellow bastards did this to us when everyone knows America is superior to Japan."
Jeez.
So that sort of sums up the thing. And Admiral Kimmel, the head of the fleet in Hawaii, told one of his lawyers during one of the investigations, "I just didn't think the Japanese were capable of such a thing."
Yeah,
they missed it because of that.
They missed it all, didn't they? And in terms of the urban myths that are out there, were we meeting with Japanese ambassadors prior to the attack?
Yeah, we met 56 times. Cordell Hull, our Secretary of State, met with the Japanese ambassadors. But they were completely kept out of the loop.
The ambassadors were? The Japanese were?
Yes, the Japanese ambassadors in Washington knew nothing about the attack.
Ah, okay. Were they in shock when it happened?
Yes, they had to be kept from a mob, a gathering outside the embassy. They came out of delivering the speech to court, the announcement to Cordell Hull ending negotiations, and he became enraged and kicked them out of his office, and they had no idea what was going on. And they come outside and there's this huge mob, and the policemen have to get them into their embassy, and that's when they find out what had happened.
Do you think dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were necessary to stop the war?
I think that they were done in order to show the Soviet Union that we had this powerful weapon and that they should stop their invasions of Eastern Europe and that it wasn't necessary for ending the Japanese war.
Interesting take. Craig, I'm going to keep you for a final hour. We're going to take phone calls with people who are interested in this situation. 75-year anniversary of the bombing at Pearl Harbor. Just an unbelievable story. And I would guess there's still a lot of pain there from family members, Craig, who
Absolutely.
Have lost people there. And our condolences to them, of course, too. At least we forget about what they went through and the heroes that got attacked on that day. We're going to be back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial.